Usually when we talk about surviving a crisis, whether that's like a literal war or just a really brutal week at the office, there's this expectation that you have to armor up.
Right, yeah. It's
Okay.
almost instinctual at this point.
Exactly. You build these walls, you hide your weak spots, and you just project this absolute unyielding strength.
Because, I mean, the world basically tells you that a rigid defense is the only way to survive. You make yourself impenetrable so nothing can hurt you.
Right. But then you step into the historical records of the Murari Chronicles, and suddenly that entire logic is just flipped completely on its head.
Oh, totally. It's wild.
So today we are diving into a landscape that really challenges everything we think we know about strength. We're exploring a pretty counterintuitive idea for this deep dive, which is vulnerability as the ultimate weapon.
Yeah, and it's such a fascinating concept to unpack.
We've got three distinct historical logs that we're looking at today, and they prove how shedding your armor, whether that's political pride, physical plating, or even emotional numbness, is sometimes the literal only way to survive truly impossible odds.
And it is a phenomenal, brutal, and honestly, ultimately beautiful journey. We are going to look at three very different figures today.
Right.
There's Lord December, who is this noble ruler locked in a generational conflict. Then there's Redmayne, a fiercely guarded paladin knight. And finally, there's Thomas, who is this chaotic, unpredictable, yet weirdly insightful fey tracker.
He really is. So let's start right in the freezing snow. We have Lord December, Redmayne, and Lord December's heavily armed knight, Sir Brovel.
Yeah, quite the trio.
Right. And they are trekking through this biting, miserable cold toward an abandoned cave. And Lord December is just on incredibly high alert. I mean, he even states that if this is a trap, the treachery will be known to all.
You really have to understand the geopolitical powder keg they're walking into here. I mean, they are deep in enemy
Yeah,
territory.
the stakes are so high.
Exactly. Lord December's people, the Fae, and the wolf shifters of this region, they've been slaughtering each other for generations. The tension in the air is thick enough to check on.
Every single step toward this cave is fraught with the possibility of a lethal ambush.
Right, it's terrifying.
But what they find inside that cave isn't an ambush at all. It's an ancient gallery. The walls are just covered in these glowing green cave paintings.
Oh, wow.
And these paintings, they reveal a world-shattering truth for Lord December. See, his whole life, the official history of his noble house, the story he was literally raised on, was that his family was chosen to rule these lands because they were inherently superior.
Ah, right.
Like they were better conquerors, stronger rulers, the undisputed top of the food chain.
Which is the classic victor's narrative, right? It's how empires throughout history justify their dominance. You convince yourself and everyone else that you deserve to rule because of some kind of innate greatness.
Exactly. But the glowing paintings show something completely different. They depict his ancestors being granted rule, not because of ruthless conquest, but because of an ancient act of profound compassion toward the wolves.
That is a huge paradigm shift.
It really is. Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine you are a modern leader, right? The CEO of a massive multinational corporation.
Okay, I'm with you.
You've built your entire identity, your whole management style, on the idea that your empire was forged by ruthless, cutthroat genius. And then you find a hidden, undeniable founding document proving your company only survived because your founder performed a random, humble act of charity.
Oh man, that would shatter the very foundation of your ego.
Totally.
Yeah.
But I have to ask, like in a real-world scenario,
Yeah.
does dropping that we're inherently superior narrative actually weaken a ruler? Doesn't baring your neck like that usually invite your historic enemies to just chop it off?
Well, what's fascinating here is that we see the immediate practical answer to that question in Lord December's next actions. And honestly, it doesn't weaken him at all.
Wait, really? It doesn't backfire?
Not at all. Because true power isn't about maintaining a flawless, unyielding facade. It's about having the courage to integrate new truths, even when they embarrass you or contradict your precious history.
Right.
Admitting past failures is actually the only way to forge a bulletproof alliance because it removes the resentment that really fuels the conflict in the first place.
And he doesn't just quietly accept this new truth either. He acts on it in a very physical way. He goes to a makeshift infirmary to meet Ersebet, an injured wolf woman
Yeah.
who has been fighting essentially alone to stop the war between their peoples.
Yeah.
And Lord December, this proud, well-armored ruler, he actually takes off his own heavy cloak and gently drapes it over her shivering body.
He literally dismantles his own physical protection to shelter the very people his family failed. I mean, it's an incredible gesture.
It's so powerful. He tells her, It is I who should be asking for your forgiveness. And then they move to the ruined Cathedral of the Fallen to meet the Wolf Elders.
This is where it gets really intense.
Yeah. So intense. He walks right up to the white-haired elder of the pack. The marble floor is dull and ruined, and Lord December just kneels.
Wow.
He bows his head and asks for forgiveness for failing to protect them. The wolves are so stunned they can't even look him in the eye. They are overwhelmed with shame for not listening to Erzsebet sooner. He bared his neck, and in doing so, he disarmed generations of entrenched hatred.
It's the ultimate display of political vulnerability. He drops the armor of his pride, and it works perfectly. It brings them together to form an alliance.
Yeah.
But of course, just as this incredibly tense political standoff is resolved, just as you think they can finally breathe for a second,
the peace is violently, literally shattered from above. We pivot from dropping emotional armor to piercing literal armor in a matter of seconds.
This transition is just pure chaos.
It really is.
Yeah.
A massive section of the cathedral ceiling just collapses. Great chunks of stone and blinding dust crash to the floor, and out of the smoke drops this monstrous creature.
Oh, this part is wild. It's made of pure, writhing shadow with burning red eyes. Splatters of corrosive black ichor hit the marble floor, hissing and smoking. And right in the middle of this absolute nightmare is Thomas.
Our chaotic fae tracker makes his entrance in the most absurd way possible.
He is literally riding on the back of this massive shadow beast, like a demented rodeo clown.
I love that image.
Right. He's got a rope wrapped around some part of its shadowy mass, straining with all his might to pull its massive jaws back so it can't snap up the unarmed wolf elders.
The scene is so visceral, you can practically smell the ozone and the rotting stench of this thing's breath.
Ugh, yeah.
The black ichor blood is spraying everywhere, sizzling on the stone as Lord December and Redmayne rush in to attack it.
But their attacks aren't working. Redmayne and Sir Braavel are hacking at this beast, and their weapons are just bouncing off. They're throwing physical sparks.
Yeah, which doesn't make sense for a shadow, right?
Exactly. And Redmayne, in the middle of the melee, realizes her blades are catching on a physical scene. This isn't just a monster made of dark magic. It has actual forged fey armor, specifically a gorget, a thick piece of throat armor hidden underneath its shadowy flesh.
Right.
Wait, here's where it gets really interesting. I need to push back on this because it makes no sense to me.
Okay, what is it?
If this is a creature made of pure shadow and dark magic, a literal manifestation of darkness, why on earth is it wearing physical forged metal armor beneath its skin? That feels like a bizarre contradiction.
It does seem contradictory until you understand the mechanics of this world. If we connect this to the bigger picture, shadows and dark magic are inherently unstable. They dissipate.
Oh, I see.
So to keep a manifestation of pure shadow anchored in the physical realm, you need a physical tether. The forged metal armor acts as a conduit to bind the magic, but it also protects the creature's core vulnerability.
Whoa.
This wasn't a random wild animal lashing out from the dark. It was a meticulously engineered assassin.
So someone built this thing.
Exactly. Someone built it, armored its vital points with physical metal, and then cloaked it in shadow to make it look like an unstoppable force of nature.
That is so creepy.
It highlights a recurring theme in Mirari. The most dangerous threats are those that hide their true nature and their vulnerabilities behind terrifying illusions. The hidden armor is a literal manifestation of what we're talking about today, you know, monsters hiding behind rigid structures.
And Redmayne, who's a brilliant, battle-tested tactician, she realizes she can't just hack through this hidden gorget. She has to bypass the armor entirely.
Right, she has to find the weak spot.
So she waits for an opening and drives her iron blade directly into the creature's eye. And because of the clash of fey magic and raw iron, the blade violently heats up, essentially boiling the creature from the inside out.
It's such a brutal way to go down, but even as it dies, as the shadows melt away from its twisted form, it gloats.
Yeah, that part gave me chills.
It looks at Lord December and tells him that its master brought it back from oblivion specifically to undo the House of December. It's a chilling reminder that defeating the physical armor of one beast doesn't mean the larger war is over.
Right, but you can't stay at that level of adrenaline forever. Surviving a near-death experience like that forces everyone's nervous system to just crash.
Oh, absolutely. The comedown is real.
The literal shedding of the monster's armor gives way to what is undeniably the hardest, most gut-wrenching part of this entire chronicle. Because now we see Redmayne having to shed the armor around her own soul.
The aftermath of extreme violence always forces a reckoning. When the physical threat is gone, the psychological defenses often just collapse.
So the battle is over. Thomas and Redmayne head to a ruined bathhouse in an abandoned building just to clean the sizzling black goo off themselves.
Right.
This leads them to a quiet makeshift room. Just a pile of hay and some old animal skins. And Redmayne, this hardened paladin who just coolly took down an engineered shadow beast, she completely breaks down. She starts sobbing violently.
It is the sudden, terrifying release of centuries of suppressed trauma. And in that quiet room, she finally reveals the horrifying truth of her past to Thomas.
She tells him she was captured by the Fomarian side in Tir Nan Og, which are the Undying Lands. Wait, before we get into what happened to her, we need to clarify this for anyone listening who isn't, like, deep into the lore.
Sure.
What exactly are the Fomarian side and the Undying Lands?
Right, let's break that down. Think of Tir Nan Og not as a magical paradise, but as a locked room where the release of death has been completely revoked.
Wait, so you literally can't die?
In these lands, death is impossible. If you fall in battle or if you are mortally wounded, you simply wake up whole a few hours later.
Oh my God.
And the Fomarian side are the monstrous, immortal jailers of this realm. They have lived so long without the consequence of death that they have entirely lost touch with human empathy.
Which makes it the absolute perfect environment for eternal, inescapable psychological warfare.
Exactly. You can't escape through death. You are trapped with your tormentors forever.
It's terrifying. So Redmayne was held in the stone tower, bound in heavy silver chains.
Mm.
And then this man comes in, Kieran, a Fomarian scholar.
Right. And what Kieran does is deeply, deeply insidious. He doesn't torture her physically, which is what she expects.
Yeah.
Instead, he feeds her by hand. He teaches her to read. He talks to her gently about her past life.
He weaponizes kindness. He grooms her and he repeatedly rapes her. But he frames the entire horrific ordeal under the guise of diplomacy.
What a twist it.
He tells her they are intermixing their peoples so they can eventually coexist peacefully. He manipulated her so deeply that she admits she didn't even realize what it was at first.
Yeah.
She says she was naive and that she even began to enjoy his company because his visits were the absolute only source of kindness she knew in that stone tower.
It is a horrifying violation because it attacks the mind and the spirit, not just the body. We think about modern psychology, this is the ultimate form of gaslighting and trauma bonding. The abuser makes themselves the only source of safety and comfort, completely warping the victim's reality. And because they are in the Undying Lands, this psychological torture goes on for an unimaginably long time.
Until one night, Kieran comes to her and says a brutal wizard is arriving to torture her. And he claims he can't bear to let that happen.
Oh.
So he unlocks her silver shackles, gives her a map to escape, and plays the savior. But the absolute second he turns his back, Redmayne snaps his neck.
She kills him instantly. And the most crucial, heartbreaking detail she shares with Thomas is that when she heard his neck snap, she felt absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all. But wait, I have to challenge this idea of numbness as a tool.
Mm.
Isn't emotional numbness incredibly dangerous?
What do you mean?
Well, in our world, we usually consider that a symptom of severe PTSD or dissociation. Not a weapon or a survival strategy.
Well, in a normal world, you are absolutely right. It is a symptom of profound trauma. But you have to remember the context of Tir Nan Og.
Okay.
In an eternal realm where your physical body cannot die and your mind is being subjected to endless psychological warfare, your emotions are the only thing left that can be destroyed. Shutting off the capacity to feel, becoming entirely numb, was the only tactical defense she had left.
Wow.
It wasn't just a symptom, it was an active barricade against total psychic annihilation.
Wow. Okay, so she fights her way out, completely numb, and makes it back to her father in her homeland of Lyonesse.
Yeah.
But when she arrives, she finds out she'd been replaced by a new, adopted son, someone her father proudly calls a real monster.
Yeah, it's brutal.
Her father looks at her, sees the trauma, and banishes her into the freezing wilderness with nothing but the armor on her back. He casts her out for being tainted, for not being monstrous enough to rule.
She survives the unimaginable, only to be rejected by the one person she was trying to get back to.
So she wanders into the wilderness, still completely numb. She eventually finds the three-faced altar of the goddess Ceridwen. She wedges a blade into a crack in the ancient stone, and she throws her own body onto it, trying to commit suicide. She just wants it to end.
But because she is Fomarian, because she is inexorably linked to the magic of the Undying Lands, she wakes up on the altar. There isn't even a scar on her chest.
But the numbness is gone. Suddenly, she is crushed by the horrific, suffocating weight of all the emotions she had suppressed for centuries. The guilt, the trauma, the violation, the realization of what her life had been.
Yeah.
So what does this all mean?
Right.
I like to think of it like a circuit breaker in a house. When there's a massive power surge, a breaker trips to stop the whole house from burning down.
Yo, that's a good way to look at it.
Her mind literally shut off the feeling switch just so she could survive the endless torture of immortality. But when she wakes up on that altar, the breaker flips back on, and the surge of electricity, the sheer volume of delayed emotion, is agonizing.
That analogy is absolutely spot on. The numbness was the tripped putter that saved her life. But you can't live in a house with no power forever. Eventually, you have to turn the lights back on.
Yeah.
And this raises an important question. How do you rebuild a soul that has been shattered and rewired like that?
Right. Where do you even start?
Well, the goddess Saradwyn speaks to her on that altar, telling her she has been reborn, and offers her a path as a paladin to atone, to find peace by actively removing evil from the world.
But the real healing doesn't start with a goddess on an altar. It starts right here, in this dirty makeshift room with Thomas. Thomas's reaction to her confession is incredible.
He really is.
He doesn't judge her for the murder. He doesn't judge her for the numbness or the trauma. He simply validates her. He tells her that not feeling was the only way she could have survived an endless war.
Yeah.
And then Thomas does something remarkable. He reveals his own vulnerability. He opens his shirt and shows her his own body, which is covered in faint, nearly invisible scars.
Thomas drops his own armor. He confesses his deep, paralyzing fear of commitment. He tells her that because he is a Fae tracker, he has outlived so many people he loved.
Oh, that's sad.
And the agony of watching them die over and over feels like someone is slowly cutting away pieces of his soul. He keeps moving, he's making chaotic jokes, and he keeps wandering because he was terrified of letting anyone get close just to inevitably lose them again.
You have these two incredibly damaged, lethal warriors sitting in the ruins of a frozen city, and they finally put down their shields. And if you're listening to this, I want you to think about the emotional armor you build to survive the battles in your own life.
We all do it.
We do. We numb out after a bad breakup. We build walls at work. We push people away so we don't get hurt. But as Thomas and Redmayne show us, you can't truly live, and you certainly can't truly connect with anyone until you are willing to take that armor off.
It is the absolute core truth of everything we've looked at today. Vulnerability is the mandatory prerequisite for connection.
Let's briefly recap the arc of the journey we've been on. We watched a powerful ruler, Lord December, shed his historical pride and literally bow his head to the wolves to save his people.
Yeah.
We saw a knight pierce the mystery of hidden forged armor to fell an engineered shadow beast. And we saw two hardened warriors drop their emotional shields to find a moment of genuine human connection in a frozen wasteland.
And what breaks my heart in the absolute best way possible is what Redmayne says she wants after centuries of endless war, torture, and survival.
It's so touching.
Thomas asks her what she actually wants to see in the world now that she's free. And she doesn't say she wants to conquer a kingdom. She doesn't want revenge on her father or to find some legendary magic artifact.
No. She says she just wants to see a wild waterfall that wasn't sculpted by magic. She wants to see wild horses running free.
Yeah.
And she wants to see children. Because in all her time trapped in the Undying Lands, she never once saw a child. She just wants to experience the simple, fragile beauties of the world.
The contrast between her brutal, heavy, immortal past and those gentle, weightless desires is profound. It's a beautiful reminder for all of us to appreciate the simple things we take for granted.
It really is. But I want to leave you with one final provocative thought from their conversation. As they are talking, Redmayne warns Thomas not to tarnish his reputation in Mirari. She tells him that in her homeland of Lyonesse, legends never truly die.
Right, the legends.
She mentions her old jousting instructor, the legendary Sir Lancelot, and she says that figures like him don't perish. They simply sleep until the world needs them again.
They wait beneath the surface for the exact right moment to be awakened.
Exactly. So I want you to mull this over as you go about your day. What parts of your own history, your own dormant talents, or your own inner legends aren't actually gone, but are simply sleeping? What parts of you are just waiting for the right moment and the right vulnerability to be awakened?
That is a very powerful question to carry with you.
We spend so much time making sure our armor is polished, making sure the jagged, ugly lines of our past are hidden away. We think that thick plating is what keeps us safe from the monsters. But when you look at the mechanics of survival, of trauma, and of human connection, you realize that eventually that armor starts suffocating you.
We like things to be secure. We want to be shielded from the unpredictable strikes of life. But it is only when you take the armor off that you can actually start to heal.
Exactly. The vulnerability isn't the weakness. The vulnerability is the weapon.